Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. And we're glad to have you with us as we go into this second hour of the show. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about current events in Turkey. And certainly, it is a very interesting time in Turkey as people there get ready sometime over the next couple of months, get ready to have a new parliament and perhaps for the first time actually vote, have a popular vote for the president. In the run-up to this balloting, there has been in Turkey intense debate about the place of religion in politics. It has historically been a secular country, and there has been a lot of debate and discussion and argument about just whether, in fact, religion has some place in politics and whether things should change or whether they should not. In addition to that, for some time now, the country has been working toward admission in the European Union. That process, too, has been controversial, as the Turkish people have thought about and argued about questions of their dual identity, in a sense, bridging the cultures of Europe and Asia. We will try to talk a little bit this morning about what these struggles mean for the future of the country and its place in the world. But our guest for the program is Rushat Kasaba. He is professor of international studies at the Jackson School of International Studies at University of Washington. That's the one in Washington State. He has talked with us before. We're pleased that he could give us some time. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask is that callers are brief, just so that we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible. But of course, anyone's welcome to join the conversation. Professor Kasaba, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I think that I have tried to at least get a good thumbnail sketch, some basic understanding of what's been happening over the last couple of months in Turkey. And I do think that it is very interesting. It may be difficult for the people of Turkey, but it also seems quite interesting as people there wrestle with these, ultimately these very big questions about their identity, about their country, about what kind of place they want it to be. One question to start out would be is how do people feel about where they are now, and do they, in a sense, are they excited about this and about this debate? Do they, in a sense, feel it's a positive thing that it's going on, or is it a worrisome thing?
I think there is a general sense in Turkey that the country is going through one of its most important political periods in these months. There is some apprehension about the next couple of months. The general elections are scheduled to be held on July 22nd. And what is unknown really is the exact way in which the president will be elected. Theoretically, president doesn't have that much power, but symbolically, it is an important position. And how that election will take place is a little unknown now. Traditionally, Turkish parliament elected the president, and right now there is a move to make it a popular election and have the people vote for it. How that will come out and how some of the other institutions in the country, especially army, will react to the outcome of these elections is unknown. So there is a sense in the country that these are very important months for a country's political future. So I would say that there is perhaps some excitement, but also quite a bit of apprehension about what's to come.
Well, let's talk a little, try and walk through a little bit about what's happened over the last couple of months. And there's really the precipitating event for this simply was the fact that as it stands now, or as it stood, the Constitution said that that the president of Turkey serves one term. He's term limited to a 7-year term. And as you say, in the past, the parliament has selected the president, and they were coming down to the time where the term of the current president, actually, I think it expired a couple of weeks ago. His term was running out, so they had to have candidates to stand for the president. And the prime minister, it appeared that the prime minister, Mr. Erdogan, was positioning himself to be the next president. And that's when things started to get difficult. Why was it that apparently many people in Turkey were opposed to the idea of Mr. Erdogan becoming the president?
Last 4 years, Turkey has been governed by the Justice and Development Party that is led by Tayyip Erdogan as the prime minister. This party has some roots in Turkey's Islamist movement, but in the period that they've been in power, they haven't really done much in terms of moving Turkey into a non-secular direction. But nevertheless, in the country, there are some established institutions, judiciary and the army, that have never really trusted him, and there was always a sense that there was a hidden agenda. And the possibility that, in addition to the government, which ironically has the real power in the country, the possibility that this party could also control the presidency, which would make him the commander-in-chief, for example, was too much for some people to accept. This is a on some people's minds, this is a genuine fear. I personally don't agree with it, but it is genuinely a problem, a concern for some people. So they tried to find ways of thwarting this parliamentary election, and in the end, a rule was brought up, which is not very clear if it is really a rule, that the parliament had to have a quorum for this election to move forward. And by using that rule, they voided the ongoing presidential election process. So the whole thing was thrown out in the open. And as a result of that, the decision was taken to go for new elections for the parliament. What is interesting is that at the same time, the government decided that the president should also be elected by the parliament, and this was put forth as a constitutional amendment last week. And actually this morning it was voted for the second time that there will be not only parliamentary but presidential elections in the country. So it is an unknown situation. But I think at the core of it is, as I said, some institutions in the country, people who represent those institutions are genuinely fearful that the possibility that two of the major executive positions in the country, the government and the presidency, would be controlled by the same party. And this party has some connection in its history to Turkey's Islamist movement. And the fear that then this would make it easy for this government or the party to take Turkey into a Western killer direction. Yeah. That is some fear, but there is also, of course, like in many other situations, on the part of some people, the realization that they're losing some of their power in the country and the society. This is a new new Turkey. It has gone through a lot of changes in the last 20 years, and these changes will inevitably reflect themselves on Turkey's political system. In a way, you can look at this as a transitional period, but it is a troublesome, it's a difficult transition. It'll be interesting to see how it is handled.
Mm. As you explained, and as we have discussed a little bit about what happened here, was that the Prime Minister, Mr. Erdogan, whose party is the majority party in the parliament, the Justice and Development Party, is essentially seen to be positioning himself to be president. There was a lot of opposition. Then he said, okay, fine. Then he put forward his foreign minister,
yes,
Abdullah Gül, and it was met with the same sort of the same sort of reaction. And clearly, people were very concerned about these men and their party. But I do, I guess I find myself wondering, I don't see, in what I have read about them, what I have read about the party, I don't see any indication that somehow they had in mind making Turkey an Islamic state. What is the state of their Islamist identity and its place in government? If in fact Mr. Erdogan became the president, what in Turkey would change?
It is, I mean, in the minds of some people, first of all, there were some symbolic issues, and these tend to acquire a lot of importance in the minds of some people. First of all, both Tayyip Erdogan and Turkey's foreign minister, Abdullah Gül, are married to women who wear headscarves. And this is somehow acquired, as it did in some parts of Europe, like in France. It is tremendous symbolic importance for Turks, for some Turks. But I think beyond that, there was also, in the way in which the Justice and Development Party handled the months that led up to the presidential election, was not very inclusive. They regarded this whole issue as if it was a intra-party problem, and they did not really try to include some other parties in the parliament or institutions into identifying a name, a person who would be acceptable beyond the party's members. Now, if Tayyip Erdogan or Abdullah Gül became president, I personally don't think that there would be a radical shift in Turkey's direction, because these people have been running the country, as I said, for 4 or 5 years almost now, and nothing of the sort has happened. But I think it would, as I said, symbolically, this would be a situation where a tremendous amount of power was concentrating in the hands of one party. Also, I think we should also add that within the party, I think this is also well known, there are groups and movements who are much more radical than the official party line. They may have a much more Islamist agenda, but this is not the case. I mean, it's not the case that this is the party's agenda itself. But people, the press and various writers in Turkey can point out to one minister or one member of the parliament or one mayor or what have you. But this is a very huge country, and fundamentally I think this is also people should accept that it is a predominantly a Muslim country, and by and large it is a conservative country socially. So what we see in the parliament and in the government represents, I think, represents to a large extent what Turkey is like, basically. So the problem, I think, I mean, the way I read it sometimes is that the institutions in Turkey, the constitution, the parliament, are becoming inadequate as places where various groups in Turkey can be represented and these issues can be debated. So that creates some bottlenecks, I think, that have to be overcome in the coming months or years.
Let me introduce again our guest, Rajan Kasaba. He is professor at the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington and has written extensively about politics in Turkey. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, after the events we talked about, after initially Mr. Erdogan looked like he was positioning himself to be president, that was met with opposition. He put forward Mr. Gül, his foreign minister. There actually, I think, was a vote, although the opposition sat out the vote in the parliament, and then the Constitutional Court came along and said, well, you didn't have a quorum, so actually this wasn't official.
Yes.
So the whole thing kind of collapsed. And then I think in response, then Mr. Erdogan said, well, fine, then let's just move up the parliamentary elections, which had been scheduled for, I think, for November. And so now we're going to have the elections in July. Do you think there, or does anybody think that the result of the parliamentary elections would be that the makeup of the parliament would be very much different than it would be today?
One thing that we haven't mentioned actually is while the presidential elections were going on with Abdullah Gül as the candidate, the army did issue an ultimatum, which strangely was posted on their website. But it was a fairly obvious kind of threat on the part of the military that they did not approve the way this problem was being handled. And that was the main factor that caused the whole process to unravel. I think that needs to be mentioned. So having said that, the military's reaction to the outcome of the July 22nd election, or possibly if there are massive street demonstrations or things of that sort leading up to the election, these are unknowns that people are very apprehensive about. In terms of the outcome of the election, most polls indicate that there will be still be a justice and development majority and perhaps a reduced majority, and the other major representation in the party will be by a combination of right-of-center parties, which were brought together partly in response to the military's demand that there be a much, you know, stronger or powerful alternative to the Justice and Development Party. Underlying all this, I also want to mention this, what you can call an almost a ultra-nationalist, bordering on paranoia and xenophobia in some ways, that is becoming prevalent in Turkey. There is a sense that the regional developments are not favoring Turkey, that there is a lot of pressures coming from outside, and that makes it a very ideal environment for some ultra-nationalist, extreme right-wing groups also in some popularity. So that is a unknown element that may surprise people, that at the end of the elections there may be a fairly strong block of votes who are representing groups who are not necessarily Islamist as such. They can be secular, but also at the same time extreme nationalists. And that can create problems for Turkey's political dialogue in the future.
We have a caller. Let's bring them in. Someone listening in Champagne and line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi. Thank you for bringing this interesting and contemporary issue to your listeners. I was wondering if the coming elections in Turkey can be seen as a referendum on whether the military should play the power, its role, the power role it's been playing since the beginning of Republic, whether the elections can be seen as a referendum on that. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Some people, I think, will see it as such, and there will always be in Turkey a substantial minority, not a majority, who feels that the military should continue to play this role of a guardian in Turkish politics. I find this somewhat dangerous, because I personally lived through, experienced at least two periods of military rule in the country. And in those times, the the regime was anything but democratic, and it did not really provide an environment for people to participate in politics or protect democracy. So I think the perception that the military can play that objective role can be somewhat misleading, and I think people should keep that in mind. But having said that, there are people in Turkey who feel that way, and they see the election as one in which actually military is not directly but indirectly taking part, because their preferences are very clear.
On the other hand, I suppose that some people would argue that at least the military showed some restraint. Yes, they weighed in. Yes, they influenced the process. But I suppose one might say, well, at least they didn't stage a coup. And I guess there were some people who were concerned that actually something like that might happen.
You're absolutely right. At the same time, without really staging a coup, they did manage to thwart a constitutional process. I think that is important to keep in mind. But the main reason, also one of the reasons that prevents them from being more assertive, I think, is the fact that Turkey's economy is now very heavily involved in international ventures. It's closely integrated with global economy. A military regime would really create a mess in that area, and I don't think if the country closed up its borders, which usually happens after a military coup, I don't think they would be in a position to handle that. That would create a lot of problems. So I think this subtle ways of affecting the process seem better for them, more practical at this point.
Well, I'm sure that if there was a military coup, that would complicate the business of joining the EU.
Yes.
To say the
Absolutely.
Least.
Yeah.
To say the
I want to also, but already the signs that have been coming from European Union since 2004, when actually there was this major milestone when Turkey was accepted as a candidate country, and things looked quite optimistic then. But the signs that have been coming from Europe since then have not been very encouraging, and I think that's one of the factors that really strengthens this ultra-nationalist viewpoint that I mentioned before. Now, compared to that period, France is ruled by a government that is opposed. The President Sarkozy is opposed to Turkey's membership. Angela Merkel is much less sympathetic compared with Schroeder. So it's a change. Blair is on his way out. There doesn't seem to be hopeful signs coming from Europe that encourages, as I said, some people who have the sense that perhaps Turkey should not really pay that much attention to Europe because Europe doesn't want Turkey anyways. And I feel that that is a failure on the part of European Union, because a different kind of policy approach to Turkey would require, you know, a real imagination. And I think that is, and these are really serious times, not for Turkey, but for the region, as everybody knows, and that I think they do require much more imaginative, courageous approaches, but we're not really seeing that at this time.
All right. Let's talk with some other people who are listening. Another Champagne caller. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I have two things I wanted to discuss. One was the place of Turkey and why some European countries are so opposed to Turkey entering the EU. But before that, I would like to ask a question. I understand that women totally participate in the life, the political life of Turkey, and they vote, of course, et cetera. And I just wonder, has anybody taken a poll of Turkish women to see if they would like to wear the veil, this symbolic veil of moving closer to an Ismailist state? Or are women in Turkey perfectly content with the secularization that has been the tradition in Turkey? And also I would like to ask, why in the world would the EU be so, countries in the EU, be so opposed to Turkey's participation, there's been the talk of Turkey must admit to having had an extermination policy against the Armenians. And, you know, but when I think about the horrible things that that Leopold did in the Congo, nobody's ever apologized for that. Nobody's ever apologized for the terrible things that both England and Germany did in its colonies, and France, too, for that matter. And so I think that saying, oh, they must admit to the genocide of the Armenians is kind of a fake reason why Turkey should not be part of the EU. So I'll listen to both responses.
Okay. let me say, first of all, the issue of veil. I'm not aware of any poll where women were asked whether they want to veil or not. But if there was a poll, and I think there were polls like this, if there was a poll where people were asked if women should be permitted to dress in whatever way they want to dress, miniskirts or veils or turban or what have you, I have no doubt that there would be an overwhelming majority of people supporting that people should be free to wear whatever they want, so men or women. And I think that's really... I don't think there's any doubt about that. So the other issue is Turkey's place in Europe. Why Europe is so much opposed to Turkey's place? I think fundamentally there is a sense among most Europeans that there is a distinct European culture, and going back to at least early modern period, 16th century, if not earlier, there was a sense that the area that is covered by Turkey is not really part of this. And I think it's not only Turkey, but the same people were really very unhappy about all EU enlargement towards the Balkans and former Warsaw, some of the former Warsaw Pact countries. This is seen as a... possibility that European culture would somehow be undermined and diluted, and that the sense of European Union will be thwarted. So there are some people who are opposed to that. Some people are opposed to the fact that this will be a very large and poor country, which would be one of the largest countries in European Union with 70 million population. But again, when Spain and Portugal joined Turkey, joined the European Union, they were poorer than Turkey is now. So I think the very membership into European Union will solve some of those economic problems. But I think the main opposition is the sense of European identity being undermined. Part of it, of course, rooted in the problems that big European countries are having with their immigrant population, because they haven't really done much in assimilating them or integrating them into their societies in the last 40, 50 years. So this membership of Turkey will make that that much more complicated. So those are some of the issues. I think it's a very big, complicated problem. And I agree with you about the whole Armenian issue. It is a very important historical problem that needs to be dealt with and discussed and openly debated. It wasn't in any of the negotiations that Turkey held with Europe that this needed to be included as a precondition. And to raise it at this last date seems to Turks that it is not really the Armenians that the European Union is concerned about, but it is just another way of creating an obstacle in the way of Turkey's membership. I'm sure these will continue to be topical in Europe and in Turkey in the coming years.
I'd like to ask a question about if women are a big voting bloc in this country. People are talking about, you know, will women of all parties turn out to elect Hillary Clinton if she's the Democratic candidate. is there any sense of what kind of party women are voting for in Turkey now?
There is a there is a feminist movement in Turkey. Talks about women's issues in a very effective way. But I think politics of Turkey are much more shaped with issues that have to do with social background, class, and ethnicity sometimes than gender per se. Turkey did have a woman prime minister about 10 years ago. But she was not really seen by most people as someone who was representing women or was particularly devoted to women's issues. So it is not really, the political debate doesn't really take place on that level. For some women, the whole veil issue or Islamic dress issue is very big and it motivates them. But other women are very active in the Islamist movement and the party, and a lot of them are very highly educated and active people. So for them, the issues obviously are different. So it's not, it hasn't become a identifier or a way of mobilizing people right now, gender issues.
I appreciate the questions of the caller. I hope she wouldn't mind if I just jump in here. We're a bit past the midpoint, and I have somebody else I want to get to. And I do want to introduce again our guest for anyone who has just tuned in. We're talking with Reshat Gesaba. He's professor of international studies at the Jackson School of International Studies at University of Washington and has written extensively on the politics of Turkey. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller, also someone in Champaign, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for this conversation. I find it to be very interesting as I've I had the chance to travel to Turkey a couple of years ago, and so I've been very interested in just kind of the politics and culture ever since then. And so it's interesting to hear that on my local radio station. But my question for you is kind of about that, about the American perception of Turkey as a political and social body. And so what kind of prompts me to ask you maybe how you feel that influences their future and the way that the United States deals with them is I received an email a while back shortly after a couple of Christian missionaries were killed apparently, and I think that was in April. Do you recall that?
Yes, yes. So, there has been several incidents like that in the last I would say 2 years or so. Yes,
right. And it seems like it's kind of the result of a small group of people that have very strong feelings towards missionaries. But we felt a general sentiment there of, I wouldn't say outright acceptance of missionaries, but certainly tolerance, you know, especially in Istanbul, which is metropolitan, more liberal, you know, certainly a tolerance of Christians there. So, you know, when someone emailed me something that said, that quoted the Turkish interior minister as saying some pretty terrible things about that, I was kind of skeptical, and so I did some research and I found some real quotes from him, and then I traced back the email that I got to kind of a evangelical blog. But it seemed like a lot of people got this information, and a lot of people, you know, probably believed it, and then there wasn't really a whole lot of stuff in the press about it, you know, short of a small segment in the New York Times. But there wasn't a whole lot of stuff in the you know, local press or national press to balance it. And so I wonder if you have seen the effects of that, do you feel like that is damaging to Turkey, and do you feel like that is, that's a problem?
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, there is a sense among certain parts of the country and the people of growing anti-Western, anti-foreign feelings. There are a lot of reasons for this. Some people are motivated probably by religious factors. Some are just outright hopelessness and poverty, and some are ideologically driven militants. So like any big country in various parts of Turkey, we do see groups who are actively opposed to any foreign influence. And when it is sometimes mixed up with religion, of course, it becomes that much more potent. So, yes, I mean, I do see this as a problem, but I don't really see it as becoming a, you know, so powerful that it affects, you know, all segments of Turkish society or all parts of the country. But it is something that is serious in two places, at least. In northern Turkey, a Catholic priest was murdered. Similarly, the incident that you mentioned happened in Southeast Asia against a Christian group. And some people who, for whatever motivations, can talk about the presence of Europeans or Christians and, you know, converting Muslims and undermining the country's culture or religion. And there are a lot of people who are ready to believe this. So I think it has to be taken very seriously, but at the same time, I don't think it should be interpreted as something that reflects the majority of Turks or majority of people in Turkey. Like you mentioned, openness and being accepting is much more typical for the country's people now.
Do you feel like there is an adequate representation of that in our culture, in American culture, from an outsider's perspective? Have you observed representation of that?
Looking at it from here, of course, Turkey is one of many similarly situated countries, so it doesn't really figure into day-to-day conversations or debates to the extent that the U.S. figures in Turkey. But for people who, you know, who want to look for a good kind of sense of what Turkey is, I think there are ways of finding it out, wherever you may be.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left. Again, our guest is Rashad Kasaba. He's professor of international studies at the Jackson School at University of Washington. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There's something that I'd like to come back to. We talked a little bit earlier about the effort earlier this month, the unsuccessful effort earlier this month of the ruling party to get first the prime minister and then the foreign minister positioned to be the next president. So after the decision was made to move up the parliamentary elections, now they're going to be in July, then also Mr. Erdogan, the prime minister, proposed something very interesting, and that was he suggested that the constitution be changed to allow the president to be elected by popular vote rather than by the parliament, which had been the case. And he was also going to restructure the terms before the president served one 7-year term, and what he has proposed is that the president would be allowed to serve as many as 2 5-year terms instead of the 1 7-year term. And apparently the parliament did approve this. And now the question is, do you actually think that this summer there will be now a popularly elected president in Turkey?
What is likely to happen is that the president, who's actually lame duck now, his term expired, but he's serving until a replacement is found, will probably veto this. But this is because this is the second time he's vetoing pretty much the same legislation, and there will be a referendum about the constitutional change. I'm not sure how quickly that referendum can be carried out. It is a very popular measure, so there is no doubt that it will pass in the referendum. But after that referendum, they'll be able to hold presidential elections. So my sense is that will probably be sometime in the fall, not simultaneously. I don't think there is enough time to have simultaneous elections both for the parliament and for the president. So it'll probably be in the fall sometime.
Mm-hmm. And so you think that there are enough people in Turkey, they would support the idea of popularly electing the president?
The opinion polls suggest that there may be upwards of 70% in favor of a measure like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, if there's the parliamentary elections in July, and then you put off this referendum on popularly electing the president, then would the new parliament, the one that comes in July, are they going to select a president, or would they just wait to see what the outcome of this referendum would be?
There are two scenarios, depending on the fate of the referendum or how, because there's a possibility that this can also go back to the Constitutional Court for whatever reasons. So there is one scenario is that the new parliament will select a president, and then the new system will take effect in the next round of presidential elections. But one scenario is if there is no delays, if there are no appeals, that the current president will serve until a new one is elected popularly sometime later this year.
Mm. Because there was this, I'm interested in what you think about what Mr. Erdogan was thinking when he proposed this. It would seem that if there was resistance to the idea of him, popular resistance to the idea of him becoming president as a result of the election in the parliament, did Mr. Erdogan actually think that if he was standing for president in a popular election that he might win?
I don't think there is any doubt that he would win.
Hmm.
But at the same time, it is not clear that the army would let him govern. So he is aware of these, you know, very important institutional constraints that still exist on what he can do. So he is confident that, you know, by and large, he has the support of a very large segment of the people. So he's trying to kind of put that force, play on that in order to strengthen his hand. I don't think he will stand as a candidate, though. I think he has pretty much decided that it will be still his foreign minister. But I don't think there is any doubt that, I mean, he is confident, and I also don't, I think he's rightly confident that he would be elected. If there was no, you know, if there was a direct presidential vote today for president in Turkey, he would be elected.
Hmm. Just returning for a bit to the subject of Turkey in the EU,
yeah.
We talked about this a little bit earlier with a caller, and certainly we've talked about this before, and it's come up on other conversations. And as you said, there was initially seemed to be some enthusiasm and excitement on both sides, both in Europe and in Turkey, about the possibility of Turkey joining the EU. This also, I guess we should note that this would, under any circumstances, even under normal circumstances, be a long process. So it wouldn't be something that would just happen right away. It would take 10 years, something like that. What happened then initially was we started to hear sentiment, really sort of anti-Turkish sentiment coming out of Europe, people on the street and perhaps also governments, because as you say, people in Europe somehow were saying, well, Turkey wasn't European. And I think then a lot of people in Turkey were really taken aback and started to reassess. Perhaps the person on the street in Turkey who started to reassess the whole idea of joining the EU because it was made clear that at least some people in Europe would not welcome them into the EU. So that just it now, given that we're at this point, do you think that this is the effort is sort of temporarily knocked off the tracks, or do you really think what we're really seeing here is the beginning of the end of the whole idea of Turkey entering the EU?
I think it is temporarily perhaps slowed down because even though some of the articles under which Turkey's membership negotiations are continuing are still on track, but some of them are suspended. There are some really serious issues that have to do with Turkey's foreign policy, with Cyprus and all, and as I said, economic problems. So these will take a while to address, but in the very long term, the process is still continuing. The negotiations are not suspended. Just recently, Sarkozy said that he was not going to veto the continuation of negotiations, which was a big concern for Turkey. So I think I'm still optimistic that in the long term this will work out. But for this to proceed further, Turkey needs to have a strong government that is committed to this issue fundamentally, and feel secure about this commitment, that they can make certain decisions that may be unpopular with certain parts of Turkish population. So that's why this ongoing political transformation in Turkey is important. It's likely to have strong implications.
Mm-hmm.
We also should mention, we didn't really touch on it that much, but the situation in northern Iraq is affecting Turkey quite seriously. There's a sense among some people in Turkey that there's an independent Kurdistan is emerging in northern Iraq, and that is affecting the security in Turkey's southeastern borders. And there is expectation on the part of a lot of people that the U.S. Will need to do more in providing some stability in that part of the country, in northern Iraq. And that is becoming a factor that is strengthening the military's hand in Turkish politics, in Turkish foreign policy, and it is a very complicated, difficult issue for the civilian government to address in the middle of this ongoing political crisis. I think that's a big, big unknown, and that is a serious problem right now.
Well, given that, I would assume that the position of the Turkish government vis-a-vis people, ethnic Kurds living in Turkey, who are demanding independence, certainly autonomy, if not independence, that's not going to change. Yet at the same time, because they have now essentially what amounts to a de facto kind of Kurdish state right over the border in Iraq, that's something that they have to confront as well. Are people in Turkey thinking, in the Turkish government, thinking any differently about how they deal with their Kurdish problem than they have in the past?
Yes, Kurds in Turkey are divided also. There's a substantial group, and I would probably think it's a majority, who are already part of the Turkish political and social canvas. But there is a strong movement led by the resistance movement, PKK, who is interested in achieving independence for the Kurds of Turkey. What relationship this would have with an independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq is not clear. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that they would join or they would just be an extension of that entity. But the fact is that some of these groups are being trained or have sanctuary in northern Iraq right now. And there are a lot of people in Turkey who are pushing the army to really go into northern Iraq and deal with this issue militarily, which, of course, would be a disaster both for Turkey's military and Turkish politics and for regional politics or Turkey's relations with the United States. But there are some people who are putting all the Kurds into one basket, as it were, and arguing that they all want a independent Kurdistan and they wanted to join with an independent Kurdish state in northern Iraq. But I think the reality is complicated, and there are a substantial part of the Kurdish community in Turkey is part of the political process. And if they were allowed to continue to be represented, to be to play a more prominent role in Turkish politics, then that would do a lot towards solving this issue.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, compromise is not always easy to come up with, and that's on all segments of Turkish society and politics today. I think our people are trying to find ways of compromising, and they need to find ways of compromising.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that so many of these things we've been talking about, and so many questions in Turkish politics, one way or another, somehow come back to this identity issue.
Yes.
And how people think about what it means to be Turkish. And,
yes,
and I think for a long time, historically, Turkey has occupied this very interesting position in between Asia and Europe, in a sense, with one foot in each place. And that's something that Turkish people seem to be comfortable with, but it seems that at least in Europe, that's not something that they've ever been. They seem to be not quite sure what Turkey is and where it fits. Do in fact people in Turkey, are they sure where they fit?
I think this is a very good question, and I think you put it very correctly. Turkey, I think people in Turkey feel comfortable by and large with this dual, triple, quadruple ways of thinking about the world, Muslim but secular, you know, all these various elements. But whenever the world conjunctures or international relations move into a direction where these rigid identities become important, like they did around World War I and like it's happening now, then Turkey finds it's hard to respond to those because of these complex elements of identity that it has within itself. So I think the international environment is right now, unfortunately, not very conducive for a people who can exhibit these various different sides and be comfortable with that. And I think we're also seeing a similar problem in Europe and in the United States too, with all the debates about immigration, which is really questioning how this country was formed and what it means to be a country of immigrants in a world where everybody is interested in their own core, very kind of essential identities. And I think that's the clash, that's really the clash that people are trying to deal with.
Yeah, well, there we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Richard Kasaba. He's professor of international studies at the Jackson School, University of Washington. Professor Kasaba, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.